It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with The Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
You're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast. And now your hosts, Ben Folks and Chad Dundas.
That's right. You're listening to another episode of the Co-Main Event Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. I'm Chad Dundas. That's Ben Folks. We're both longtime MMA journalists. And for the last 9 years, we've been meeting here every single week to break down all the action in the wild, weird, and occasionally wonderful world of mixed martial arts. Ben, how you doing this week?
Not so great, Chad.
Not great? What's
Not
going
so
on?
Great.
Is there anything we can help you with?
I don't know if you've been outside lately, but we are living in a post-apocalyptic scenario every single day here in Montana.
Yep. Pretty smoky out there.
It's to the point, I was earlier today, as longtime listeners of the podcast will note, I've mentioned once or twice having recently bought a new house, which I'm seems like constantly doing stuff to, was at a carpet place earlier today, looking at carpet to put down in my basement office, and nobody, it seemed, could get through a conversation without coughing. And you realize, that's just how we live in the summertime in Montana now, and it's not great.
Now, are you... I mean, there's only one or two ways you can go here. You can try to hide from the smokes, stay indoors, you know, put together some puzzles. I don't know, curl up with a cozy mystery, or you can get out there and do your normal stuff. Which side are you coming down on so far?
Well, I might be coming down on the side of getting out of town, going somewhere where it's not so smoky. But other than that, you know, man, I don't know if you've ever. Once you get sucked down the YouTube rabbit hole of trying, like you encounter a home fix issue where you're trying, like, how do I get one of those big ass clothesline poles out of my backyard? Man, YouTube has some thoughts.
Yeah.
It has some thoughts and some ideas. And a lot of them will start off with, hey, like in the description, it'll be like how to remove a giant ass clothesline pole with just stuff you have around the house. And then you get into the list of stuff that they think you have around the house. And you realize you might need to consult a different YouTube video. But that's kind of how I'm spending my days.
There is no human endeavor that does not have a how-to video on YouTube. That's been my experience. And you know what? As a homeowner, thank God.
Yeah.
Thank God those videos are out there. I have no idea how people even knew how to do shit before that, before YouTube was out there providing this, awesome service of telling us how to restart our sprinklers in the spring and get the giant ass clothesline poles out of our yards and whatnot. I mean, I guess everyone must have had a know-it-all uncle.
Yeah.
Back in the olden times.
That's
the YouTube
right.
of old was
you had
the,
to you had to seek out an old codger in a shack and just have him tell you what to do and what moon to do it under.
I think that's right. I think that's how it went. Remember, you're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast proper. This show drops every Monday afternoon for free in your timelines or podcast libraries. But if you think we're having fun right now, You absolutely need to go check out what's going on over at the Patreon page, patreon.com/co-main-event. Ben Folks and I are party rocking over there all week with three additional podcasts. If you don't get your MMA fix from this show, you can check out the Wednesday live chat, #WildOnWednesday, where we spend a full hour answering your questions. Or you can go straight for the Friday Power Hour, which is an additional hour of curated MMA talk every single week. It features the dreaded but amazingly named co-main event podcast, Patreon Power Hour Power Rankings, the most powerful force in all of podcasting as far as we know. And of course, we got the Thursday Movie Club for the real heads, for the top level patrons over there. We're fixing to kick off a month, another month of focusing on an actor or actress. We just wrapped up Nicolas Cage movie month. Right now we got a vote going on over at the Patreon page to decide what we're going to do next month, Ben. And Charlize Theron and Jodie Foster are locking horns. They're neck and neck right now.
Yeah. It's too close to call right now.
It truly is. And not much time left in the vote here. So we hope to have an answer by Wednesday as to what we're doing for the next movie club themed month. So if you want to get down with that, just head over to the Patreon page, patreon.com/co-main-event. Sign up to join the team. We would love to have you. We have fun over there. We got music this week from our guy, Simeo, Stockholm-based producer, a.k.a. Co-Main Event podcast listener, Alfred Larson. If you like what you hear from him on the show, you can check out more over at soundcloud.com/Simeo. That's S-E-E-M-I-O. Three rounds, as usual, this week in the Co-Main Event podcast. In round number one, we know he has Habib's support. But does Islam Makhachev have the goods at lightweight? Ben, we're saying Makhachev now.
Sure, fine.
Maybe we've been saying that the whole time. I don't know. Islam Makhachev.
I predict we'll go through at least three or four different pronunciations this show alone.
I mean, just in terms of the general culture, I feel like we got to decide on a pronunciation and stick with it. I don't want Islam Makhachev to become the UFC lightweight champion and all of a sudden we're going with a different pronunciation, right?
Don't act like it would be the first that not happens. I mean,
no, man, I feel like we were all rolling along steady with Habib Nurmagomedov, and then all of a sudden they show up on the UFC broadcast one time and it's Habib Nurmagomedov, just like putting the emphasis all over the different syllables. It's too much, man. I can't keep up.
You know who I blame is John Anik for actually trying to get the pronunciations right. Back in the Mike Goldberg days where he was just going to say whatever he wanted to. You know what? It was a simpler time.
Yep. I agree. I think we should blame dedicated, hardworking professional John Anik for trying to get shit right. In round number two, as CME listener Brandon Boyd noted on Saturday night, is Miesha Tate once again destined to be better than everyone in the women's bantamweight division except the champion? And in round number three, what does Tyler Jeffrey Dillashaw have left to offer the men's bantamweight division? And how much do we care? All that plus are you fucking kidding me and just saying stuff. But first, like we always do about this time, let's do a little bit of listener mail.
Listener mail.
First piece of listener mail this week comes to us from minor Seinfeld character Jake Jarmel.
Okay.
He writes, and see here, the subject line, blackmailing Dana White.
See, that's how you get our attention. He knows what he's doing.
That's how you get yourself on the show right there. Subject line, blackmailing Dana White. He writes, fellas, Jeremy Stevens just suffered his 18th UFC loss. That's a lot. He ain't won since 2018. Along his way, Dana White bailed him out of jail so he could fight, and he injured an opponent at the weigh-ins with no repercussions. The only thing I can think of is he has some photos of Dana naked right after, quote, he was in the pool. You know what? The UFC does seem to have a soft spot. Yeah, I can see you over there shaking your head. Yeah. And with good reason, by the way. With good reason.
Although at least if we're being minor Seinfeld characters, at least we're working in minor Seinfeld references. I guess I have to respect it.
Yeah, yeah. Jeremy Stevens seems like one of these guys the UFC has a bit of a soft spot for.
Yeah.
And I feel like it is probably based on fighting style and don't give a fuck attitude more than anything else. You can pretty easily imagine Jeremy Stevens being one of these guys where Dana White is like, oh, I love this kid. I love his attitude. I love everything he stands for. 35-year-old kid Jeremy Stevens. But I don't know. It does feel like he has had a lot of rope in his UFC career. I think he has the fighting style that the UFC likes to have a round to fill out cards like this, like we had on Saturday night for this fight night event. And, you know, he's been a, I guess you could say, consistent worker for the UFC over the years. So I don't necessarily know if there has to be a conspiracy here. I just think that he embodies a lot of what Dana White for years now has wanted to promote and wanted to instill in the fighters of the UFC.
Yeah, it does seem like Dana White can sometimes make up his mind, I like this guy. And then the more other people are like, hey, maybe we don't like this guy, the more Dana White doubles down on, nope, like him. And as long as he, you know, continues to be easy to work with and all that stuff, maybe he likes him for like the high just bleedness that Jeremy Stevens tends to bring. You know whose tweets, though, I really enjoyed while Jeremy Stevens is getting ready to fight on this UFC Fight Night event is Drakkar Klose, who was the guy who Jeremy Stevens shoved at the weigh-ins and injured him and then was like, I'll never fight that guy because I don't condone that kind of behavior. And everybody was like, the behavior of getting injured when you like shoved him? But I was paying attention to his Twitter on Saturday night. First off, he's going to start off with a who the fook is fighting tonight? Hashtag UFC Fight Night. That one's for the hardcores. You know, that one's for the heads. Then later on, he notes after, you know, Dana White had called Jeremy Stevens a savage and Jeremy Stevens said, oh, like that guy got in my face and the primal side of me just came out. That's why I shoved him. He issues these tweets. So savage, the only fight at Lil Heathen MMA won in 3 years was against a man with his hands behind his back at weigh-ins. Okay. And then after he gets quite easily taken down and basically gets his head sat on and Kimura'd by the big homie Gamrot, then Drakkar Klose is like, that must have been the human side, not the primal side. Finally, then he's going to just tweet at Little Heathen MMA, and it's that meme of the guy sticking his head out from behind a tree, rubbing his hands together, except the face has been replaced with Scott Coker's face. So that's clearly doing a thing here. And by the way, I assume this is the future of successful podcasting, someone just describing tweets that they see. And then finally, a screenshot of Gamrot sitting right on Jeremy Stevens' head as he's locking up the Kimura, and it just says, hashtag primal, hashtag savage, what that smell like.
Wow, so, good work from Drakkar Klose.
Doing a thing.
I had no idea he was such a prolific tweeter or such a savage burn artist.
Yeah, if you give him reason to turn against you, you know, he's going to go after you scorched earth, it seems.
I guess so. Do you think this is the end of Jeremy Stevens in the UFC?
I mean, he's one of those guys at this point where he's been around long enough that he's probably making pretty decent money, right? And so if you're going to, it's not just a small matter to put that guy on a card and have him come in if he's not going to be capable of doing anything. And yet it does seem like sort of the old Lorenzo Fertitta attitude of, I like guys that war, that Jeremy Stevens does kind of check off that box. Plus,
yeah,
you know, if you cut him, he's showing up in bare knuckle within the month, right?
Yeah, for sure. Jeremy Stevens' last three wins, 2017, 2018, Josh Emmett, Duho Choi, and Gilbert Melendez. So just a kind of a blast from the past to even read his recent successes. Next question this week comes to us from JG, who writes, can Rodolfo Vieira fill the Damian Maia-shaped hole in Ben's heart? I don't know. What do you think here, Ben? Rodolfo Vieira, now 3-1, I believe, in the UFC. This dude, in his 9 professional MMA fights, has never gone the distance a single time. He's only made it into the third round twice, once back in 2017, once on Saturday night. But he does lock up the rear naked choke submission victory here to at least get back in the win column. What do you think? Middleweight submission ace, Rodolfo Vieira. Is there a spot for him in Ben Folks' heart? Or is there some kind of deep-seated Brazilian jiu-jitsu feud happening here that we don't know about?
Well, I think what you need to understand here when you're talking about filling the Damian Maia-shaped hole in my heart, it's like, you know, your dog dies, you don't go out and get a puppy that weekend.
Yeah.
No, you need some time.
You need some grieving time.
Yeah. You need some time to honor the memory of the dog who was your loyal companion for many years before you go out and just try to replace him and pick up someone new. So the short answer is I'm not ready. I'm just not ready to get back out there yet, man. But I will say, Rodolfo Vieira, I see what you're doing. I got my eye on you. And we'll see where it goes. Although, he does have himself a submission loss. Which, I don't know, does that hurt your cred if you're going to be the jiu-jitsu guy?
Yeah, he lost via guillotine choke to Anthony Hernandez just back in February. So that might, maybe that does hurt your resume a little bit. See, I hear what you're saying, that you're not ready. But then you end up going to the Humane Society. You're rolling around on the floor with the soft, cuddly little puppies. They're licking your face. They're biting your fingers with their razor-sharp little puppy teeth. And next thing you know, you come home with a new dog. Could that little dog be Rodolfo Vieira stealing your heart?
It's possible. It's possible that I could be won over, but I'm going to need to see more.
Wow. He's guarding his heart, ladies and gentlemen. He's not ready. He's not ready to give it away again. Next question this week comes to us from professional footballer Cedric Itten. He writes, "Well, hello, my friends, from here in sunny Glasgow. I'm sitting here at halftime during the Rangers versus Arsenal game and can't get the idea of poor little Conor McGregor and his broken leg and ankle out of my mind, so please help me. I cannot seem to reason with myself that Conor or his team thought it was a smart game plan to enter a fight with Dustin Poirier and immediately start leg kicking the dude. I mean, it's either really stupid or a good way to ensure he has an excuse, given he was going to lose the fight anyway. Also, come on, man, are we really saying that the UFC and their doctor both knew of existing stress fractures and allowed the fight to happen? It's not like they have a responsibility to fill in pre-fight medicals, etc. properly, huh? Surely a practicing doctor risks being struck off or disbarred, and the UFC surely risked their fight license and health insurance if it found is found to be lying on a fighter's pre-fight health screens, unless, of course, the commission is also in on it. Well, the second half is about to kick off, so cheerio for now."
Before we get into this, I don't know if you could hear it, but right now, right outside my window, a woman in a golf cart drove by with like a boombox playing, and she was pulling behind her golf cart a wagon, and that wagon had like an ice cream cooler with like stickers. So it was like a DIY ice cream truck.
Okay. Yeah, neighborhood ice cream truck. I like it.
And is blaring some kind of music, but it's not exactly ice cream truck music. It's just something to make you look out the windows to go, who the hell is doing that? Oh, ice cream. And then she's just kind of driving slowly through the neighborhood looking for customers. I mean, I guess I got to respect the hustle.
Yeah, I respect the fact you're still in your chair right now.
It's just,
you're not running down the street after the makeshift ice cream, man.
She wasn't going very fast. I think I could probably catch her when we're done.
It's possible. She'll come around again. Also,
okay, on this topic, especially of the pre-fight medicals, and did he falsify the form, as we've seen fighters get accused of in the past? We even saw the dude in Bellator get suspended by the Mohegan Commission. And there's talk, you know, about like, hey, is that what he's doing here? Is he just bullshitting about the stress fractures to begin with? Can you imagine a world, Chad, where we actually want fighters to be totally honest on the pre-fight medical questionnaires? Because we can sit here and act like we want that, but we do not want that. Like, the sport would grind to a fucking halt if people actually did that. And you know it. We'd never get through a car with, like, we'd never make it all the way to fight night without scratching one or two bouts, because the commissions would have to look at the medical forms and be like, I see here your rib is currently broken. Like, Michael Bisping went into that fight with George St. Pierre ready to inject himself with lidocaine in the locker room with a doctor talking him through it on FaceTime. And only didn't do it because he was worried he was going to screw it up and like puncture his lung or something. But that kind of stuff is pretty normal for fighters, like that level of injury to be carrying into a fight. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, we would have to admit that we would rather them keep quiet on the medical forms. The athletic commissions would rather them keep quiet on the medical forms. And then when you come out afterwards and talk about how you had like an exposed brain and half a lung, and that's why you lost this fight, that's just a time-honored tradition, and we should let you have that. I mean, yeah. I guess it's like, what are you going to do? Even if the Nevada Commission is probably not looking to punish anybody for this, or even really, unless there's a whole lot of pressure, probably doesn't even want to look into it. Doesn't even want to have a conversation with Conor McGregor, if they can at all avoid it. But the last person they want to get sideways with is somebody like Conor McGregor, who draws enough water with the UFC, he could sit there and say, you know what, I don't like the way I was treated by Nevada last time. have me fight somewhere else and could probably get that done. And Nevada wants him to keep bringing in the millions and millions of dollars that an event like this brought in. And so they don't want to do anything. And even if they did do so, what are you going to, you're going to suspend him 6 months when he's sitting around with a broke ass leg that he's not going to be able to fight on for like at least a year? That wouldn't mean anything. Everybody would just be sort of like playing their games, trying to appear as if they're responsible.
Yeah. Everyone involved in the equation is financially incentivized to make sure that a Conor McGregor fight goes off as scheduled. So I don't really have a hard time believing that he could come into a fight with some manner of leg injury and that all parties involved might look the other way or, you know, they would not even want to know how much they don't know about what's going on with his physical condition before he gets in there. The two things that strike me about this Conor McGregor driving around on his rascal through the streets of LA, shooting a video of himself talking about his stress fractures are, number one, he's clearly just fallen all over himself in his haste to not give Dustin Poirier any credit for winning the fight at UFC 264. Number two, like as we talked about on Friday during the Power Hour, I know Conor McGregor is a tough guy, and I know that he probably is more of a shit-eating wild man when it comes to competition than I think we give him credit for on an ongoing basis. But if you got multiple stress fractures in your leg, as he said, and I believe professional footballer Cedric Itten brings it up in this email, do you go out with a game plan to kick the shit out of Dustin Poirier's legs as hard as you possibly can if your own legs are already compromised? We looked up the stats on Friday during the Power Hour. Conor McGregor, 8 of 8 in strikes to the legs during the, almost 5 minutes that this fight went on for. Like, and maybe he did, maybe he would, I don't know. Like I said, I think he's a tough dude and like probably willing to grit his teeth through the pain and go out there and execute his game plan. But if you were McGregor or one of the people around him and you really did have like serious compromising injuries to your legs, wouldn't you be like, hey, man, maybe we switch up the game plan a little bit here. Maybe we don't throw those heavy leg kicks so much in the early going. To me, like that would be a major strategic failing more than anything else on the part of McGregor or his team.
So you're saying when we're trying to look back on whether we won or learned after this fight, maybe one of the things to learn is if your leg is all fucked up, don't go trying to use it as a baseball bat.
Yeah, something like that. Although I didn't, hasn't John Kavanaugh in the wake of this thing come out and basically said everything was going great?
Yeah, well, yeah, he was very pleased with that first round. But yeah, I mean, I could also though see if I'm trying to put myself in the heads of Conor McGregor and his camp, that even if they're thinking like, okay, we've had some problems with that leg, whatever, but you got through it and everything, and maybe we need to kick to sort of forestall his kicking game. Maybe the thing we can't allow is to let Dustin Poirier come out here and establish that calf kicking game. And so even if it means having to kick with an already hurt leg, maybe if that's even how we hurt the leg, was going out here and kicking him without kicking our training partners, without shin pads on, which is what McGregor said that he'd been doing, which I don't know if I see the wisdom in that. But can't you see how they might have thought like, okay, it's a little risky. Maybe we're already dealing with this injury kind of stuff, but that there's no way they thought, I don't know, man, maybe you shouldn't do it because then at one point, maybe you'll just plant on your leg and it will just crack like a fucking popsicle stick and break underneath you. Like there's no way they thought that was going to happen.
Right. I mean, it's a little bit of we have the benefit of hindsight, right? And if Conor McGregor goes out and throws the low leg kicks and wins that fight, then maybe he's sitting here today talking about the genius, the fighting genius of Conor McGregor. And, you know, if he goes out there and kicks the legs and it doesn't work or he gets injured or something else happens, then I guess we circle back and we talk about how it wasn't great. But
Mistakes were made.
Next question this week comes to us from Just Matt.
Okay.
Who writes, happened upon a tweet with the latest random drug test figures for UFC fighters. Hello, Abu Azatar. I'd love to take the UFC leadership to task for Robin Baron-style business practices, but bringing in USADA seems to at least have quieted the conversation around PED use among UFC fighters. Some guys get dinged, but that just seems like the system working. How improved is the PED situation now versus 2015?
I think it's definitely improved, don't you?
I mean, yeah, it seems like it has, I think, like the UFC has very stringent, very tough, very kind of personally invasive drug testing. Man, they have more invasive drug testing than any of the other mainstream professional sports, mostly because there wasn't a labor union there to have to deal with in coming to terms with what that drug testing policy was going to be. And I think when they instituted that policy, they had to have one. It had gotten to the point with TRT and everything else that the headlines had gotten so bad and the news had gotten so bad, and some of the fighters, aka Vitor Belfort, were showing up looking like cartoon superhero drawings of themselves, that the UFC had to go out and do something. And I think that they accomplished their goal, and it's, and that no drug testing policy is going to be completely infallible. No drug testing policy is going to be foolproof, and no drug testing policy is going to prevent all PEDs use. And anytime you got people competing over money, people are going to try to cheat. And so there's probably still some PEDs use in the UFC. But I think that the UFC first and foremost wanted a PR solution to what was going on with the performance enhancing drug situation in MMA. And I think they got a pretty good one at this point. And whether or not fighters are still using PEDs, we don't really know. But having talked to a fair amount of fighters over this period, I definitely get the impression, and obviously some of them are still taking PEDs, but I definitely get the impression that most fighters are sort of like, it would be hard now to do it just because of the way drug testing works, that like, I'm sure people are still cheating, but like, I wouldn't know how to start. Really?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's too, when we were doing their athletic fighter survey, that's one of the questions was, do you think it's improved? Do you think people should? And a lot of people said, you know, I'm sure that there's some of it still going on, but yeah, you have to be more sophisticated about it. And I mean, in a week where we are about to see the return of TJ Dillashaw, there's probably not a great chance that TJ Dillashaw gets popped under the old system where it was just athletic commissions. If you were fighting in a place with an athletic commission at all to begin with, and most of them were only doing sort of fight night testing or testing around the fights that you could really mark on your calendar and avoid if you had any sort of awareness about it at all. But also, like, you mentioned the stuff about like Vitor Belfort walking around looking like a cartoon character on TRT, the UFC accidentally emailing out his drug test results to a whole bunch of people that shouldn't have had them to begin with. Stuff like that definitely played a role. So too, though, did stuff like the Kung Lee situation, where the UFC, at a time when it was really trying to aggressively expand its international presence and break into new markets, and so it goes to a bunch of places that don't have athletic commissions. And it did what it could to help set up some athletic commissions, at least like in name, in places like Brazil, where it knew it was going to be going back a whole lot of times. But like other places, like it goes to Macau, and it knows that it alone is going to be responsible for doing the drug. If there's going to be any drug testing going on at all, the UFC has to do it itself. But then that opens up a whole can of worms that the UFC did not anticipate, or at least wasn't really prepared to deal with. And the situation with Kung Lee, where everybody already had their sensors up because he showed up in that picture with really good lighting, with his shirt off, looking pretty jacked for a man of his age, like in his 40s. And then afterwards, the UFC said he tested positive for HGH. And Kung Lee and his team came right back and were like, no way, you know, test the B sample. And then that's when we dug into it and learned the UFC basically used some lab in the area that was like a occupational drug testing lab that was in no way equipped to test for HGH. And after they came back with a positive test for HGH, they destroyed the B sample. Couldn't go back there and get it tested by a real lab then. And so it was like, that kind of colossal screw-up shows you why you shouldn't be in the position of doing this yourself. And if you can hand it off to USADA, if there are screw-ups or if there are just stuff like John Jones's picograms or stuff where guys are getting popped for things that are in supplements and that they genuinely have no clue about and really could not have been expected to know about, at least then you have USADA to share some of the blame, if not take all the blame. You can always just point to USADA and be like, hey, they're a reputable anti-doping company, and we pay them a whole bunch of money to take care of this stuff. So if you have an issue with it, talk to them. And it takes it off the UFC's plate. And I do think that a lot of it is just like a psychological change in the fighters, that if they start to look around and they go, well, hey, they got TJ Dillashaw for EPO. I know they've showed up at my house at 6 a.m. times that I'm not inspecting them. Maybe you just start to feel a lot less confident in your ability to get away with it. And maybe that's how the sport gets a little cleaner. The playing ground at least gets more even if everybody has to worry about the same thing.
Yeah, I think that there are positive and negative things you can probably say about the policy. It's not perfect. Like I said, it's invasive to the fighters, and people are probably still getting around it. But if the question is, did it largely serve the purpose that the UFC wanted it to serve? I think the answer is yes.
Yeah.
All right, that's going to do it for listener mail this week. Remember, if you have a question, comment, or concern that you would like to air to the podcast in future weeks, you know how to do it. Go to our website, comainevent.com, and click the link in the top right-hand corner of the screen that says email the podcast. That'll get you in touch with us. As for right now, though, we're going to go ahead and get started with round number one. Well, Ben, Islam Makhachev essentially wears Thiago Moises around the cage like a hat for a little over 3.5 rounds, I'm sorry. Wins the fight here by rear naked choke. I believe he is now riding a lengthy win streak here. 8 wins in a row. These most recent two, Drew Dober and Thiago Moises, I think the highest profile wins he's got. The general consensus appears to be at this point, it's time to give Islam Makhachev a contender. It's time to give him a slightly higher, slightly more recognizable opponent here, and we can finally get around to start figuring out whether or not this guy has the goods at 155 pounds, where there is already, obviously, an extremely crowded title picture. We know he has the support of training partner and former lightweight champion Khabib Nurmagomedov, who's basically saying he's the heir apparent to me. How'd you come out of this fight feeling? Do you think like Islam Makhachev can be that guy? Can he be the new Khabib at 155 pounds? And do we need him to be, and do we want him to be, I guess, are the questions.
Well, first of all, when I hear you struggling to get his winning streak down right, what I take away from that is, much like Conan the Barbarian, Islam Makhachev has gotten to a point where his wins cannot easily be counted.
Yeah, 8 in a row now in the UFC, 20-1 overall as a professional for Islam Makhachev.
Second of all, I want to point out, we were sitting around here talking about our bets on $20 You Never Want to See Again last week during the CME Power Hour, available to our beloved patrons every Friday. And I took Makhachev via KO and via submission, basically betting he was going to finish this fight. You, I believe, took him by decision.
I did,
yeah. If I'm not mistaken, because you looked at some of those recent fights and said that he tends to go to decision a lot. I pointed out, with 5 rounds to work, a guy like this style, the same style that Khabib had in a lot of ways, those extra 2 rounds make a big difference. Because he's not like a one-punch hard hitter. He's not that opportunistic a submission grappler. But he is just relentless. And you could see it in Thiago Moises' face as this fight went on. You could see the hope that he was going to win this fight start to drain away the more he just felt what it was like to be in. And so it's one thing to get through 3 rounds of that, to get through those next 2 rounds when you're already exhausted and feeling like, you know, there's no hope for victory here. I think that makes a big difference, and that's when those kind of guys really start to get to you. And I don't, you know, he gets on the mic after this win and starts talking about, hey, how come nobody wants to fight me? And I think it was Paul Felder maybe who made the point, like, well, we just saw what happens. And I think there's some of that. I think there's some of that same thing. Khabib dealt with it when he was coming up. Kamaru Usman dealt with some of it when he was coming up. When you're that kind of a fighter where somebody looks at your style and they go, man, even if I beat this guy, it might be tough to look good against him. And right now, if he doesn't have a huge name, what's is the risk worth the reward to go in there with a guy like that if you can absolutely, like, if there's any way at all to avoid it, if you can get some other kind of fight. But if the UFC has decided that they like him, they want to support him, either because they think that he can go far or he's Khabib's buddy or whatever, they're putting him in five-round main events. If they're going to go around putting the pressure on people in the top 10, like, hey, one of you guys has to fight this dude, we're going to offer you him and nobody else so that if you turn it down, you just extended your contract and you might end up sitting on the shelf for six more months without making any money. Like, that can start to ratchet up the pressure on some of those people where somebody's going to have to go in there and try their hand against him.
Yeah, we've seen Michael Chandler respond. We've seen Dan Hooker respond. I saw our guy Mike Bad to the Bone over on MMA Junkie tossed out Rafael Dos Anjos as a potential opponent. And honestly, RDA seems like a good move to me. Not only as kind of a step up in competition for Islam Makhachev, a former champion, a guy who is a stiff test for almost anybody at that weight, and the kind of guy who kind of seems like a true gatekeeper, and I mean that as a compliment, in that if you can beat Rafael Dos Anjos, you're legit. You would deserve to be considered an elite 155-pound fighter for the UFC. And he's also a guy who might actually take the fight, I think, as another positive in RDA's column. Whereas if you think about a guy like Michael Chandler, who's already, by all rights, probably knocking on the door for another title shot with another win or two after we get this whole Dustin Poirier, Charles Oliveira, maybe Conor McGregor situation sorted out. And then Dan Hooker, I think, is interesting too. He would be another interesting matchup. When you think about those names, is there anybody that stands out to you as being the right choice or a fitting choice for Islam Makhachev? Or is there somebody else that you were thinking about who might make sense? Because at this weight, you kind of got no shortage of dudes, as we always say.
Yeah, I think RDA makes the most sense. Although it seemed like, you know, plenty of people were putting RDA's name in the streets along with Islam Makhachev after this fight. And I didn't exactly see Dos Anjos seem to be in a hurry to jump up and take that one. And you can tell, you know, it's like we were talking about when Sean O'Malley needed an opponent, and there were a whole lot of people who couldn't say yes fast enough to that one. And this guy needs an opponent next, and everybody's like, I'm just going to sit very still and hope that somebody else steps up. I think Michael Chandler, I can understand him saying, like, look, I just fought for a title, and I still consider myself to be right in that wheelhouse, and you want me to fight some dude who's just coming off, you know, a win over like the 14th ranked guy or whatever, and in a fight night main event kind of thing. Like, I can understand how he would think that the upside for me is not quite big enough there. And maybe if he wins one more, then we can talk about it. But I think Dos Anjos does, you're right about him being still good enough to be that kind of gatekeeper. Like, and honestly, most divisions need a gatekeeper for this exact reason, to help you figure out who's really there and who's not there yet. He fits that bill. I could also see him being like, man, so I had to fight Khabib, and now I got to fight his protege. Like, didn't Khabib? Isn't that one the one where Khabib set the UFC takedown record for a fight at the time against Dos Anjos?
That may well be.
And then now I got to go fight his buddy. Like, he's out the game. I'm still in it. I got to deal with the little Khabib. Like, man, this is some bullshit. This is number one bullshit. I wouldn't blame RDA for feeling that way.
Yeah, when you got a 29-year-old Dagestani lightweight who's 20-1 overall hunting around for a fight, there's a lot of guys probably telling their managers to just, you know, drop their phones in the pool accidentally. I don't know, man. I got to get a new phone. I must have missed your call. Mm-hmm. Skills-wise, and obviously I don't necessarily know that this fight against Thiago Moises was a scintillating one, although he did get the late stoppage there. But he appears to be very, very good to me. If anything, the striking combinations look sharper than what Khabib was able to do on the feet. I don't necessarily know that the grappling is 100% as suffocating as a guy like Nurmagomedov, but again, we judge Khabib now in hindsight, having seen him reach his apex, reach his zenith, reach the highest level of evolution from him that we saw. Islam Makhachev maybe still something of a work in progress, but he seems really good, and I think the only thing left to do with them is to find a test for the guy. So somebody's going to have to do it at some point. And I just don't know who that's going to be yet.
Don't you think, I mean, he has a lot of positive things to say about Khabib and about how he wants to be compared to Khabib and likes him just as a person and as a mentor, and so he does not shy away from that comparison. But it occurs to me that we might be doing the guy a little bit of a disservice to be constantly being like, let's see how you stack up against one of the most dominant champs the UFC ever had.
Right. Well, I mean, but Habib's camp is doing it, though. Like, yeah, they're, some of
they
that
absolutely are.
Messaging is coming from them. Like, it was, we talked about this on Friday, too, that Habib talking about how we thought he would be there by now. If anything, he's a little late in yes, like, taking over for me as champion, which is a very Habib thing to say, a very wrestler guy thing to say, frankly. But yeah, I agree. Like, those are pretty hard shoes to fill, to be expected to be the next, pretty much one of the greatest fighters at any weight class that we've ever seen is, those are lofty expectations, to say yeah, the least. All right, let's do Are You Fucking Kidding Me, Ben, and then we'll move on to round number two. Ben, what's your Are You Fucking Kidding Me this week?
Well, Chad, I know that you saw when Amanda Lemos knocks out Montserrat Ruiz, and then Waleed Ismail is going to get his chance to get in the cage and get on the mic. You know, it doesn't matter what Lemos says at in response to these questions. Waleed's going to go out there and he's going to cut a promo,
yeah,
on behalf of his fighter, and just mm-hmm, bring that sort of raw energy that he has always brought to it. And honestly, I kind of appreciate it. I was trying to kind of put him and his whole deal in context for somebody when I was writing my athletic mailbag this week. And I was looking at his Wikipedia page, and it was talking about a sort of famous gym fight that he got into with Edson Carvalho at a judo gym in Brazil, where it sounded like from a lot of people who were in the scene back then that maybe Waleed was not the easiest guy to be friends with or to be training partners with because of that same intensity, Chad.
Right. Yeah. Now, he's been bringing that intensity since the mid 90s. In
yes,
fact, Waleed Ismail had a reputation as kind of a loose cannon back in the Wild West pioneer days of MMA, yeah, right?
Back so when, like, everybody was loose cannons, he was a loose
yeah,
cannon.
That's like Dave Mustaine getting kicked out of Metallica for being too big of a drunk, right? Like, that's, man, that's, you got a problem. If the other dudes in Metallica are looking around being like, you need to clean yourself up, Dave. Like, that's how it is if other early MMA practitioners were looking at Waleed Ismail being like, this dude's crazy, man.
Here's the story of that gym fight as told by the judo luminary in Brazil, Jorge Medi, who was the guy who, it was his judo academy. And afterwards, people have been like, oh, did, you know, Carvalho's friends and family jump in there to help him? And he was trying to set the record straight. Here's the story that he told about the fight. Quote, the fight started in my academy. I ordered Waleed and Edson to stop. They conceded, but soon started it again. Then I sent them outside because my academy is not the place for this type of fight. Since they would not let go of each other, I had to push them outside, close the doors, and call the cops. And the fight out there went on for half an hour since the police were not coming quickly. Sometimes I opened the door and tried to separate them, but it was like separating a dog fight. Edson did not obey me, and then I asked Waleed to stop it, asking for mercy. He replied, quote, not even dead. It is important to remind you that at no moment Edson's brother helped him. Waleed and Edson fought alone. When the police arrived with reinforcements, Edson left. I took Waleed with a totally disfigured face to the restroom and had him cleaned. Afterwards, he was taken to the hospital, wherein he stayed for days. Are you fucking kidding me? Not even dead,
not
he replies.
Even dead.
When you try to break up the gym fight that has been physically pushed out onto the sidewalks with the doors closed behind them. Are you fucking kidding me, bro?
Fucking kidding me. Well, I was actually going to go with my Are You Fucking Kidding Me about the same fight. Amanda Lemos and Montserrat Ruiz. Obviously, Lemos gets the 35-second TKO here. She's out there cracking. Landing punches like you rarely see yeah, a person land in the strawweight division. Certainly seems like an up-and-coming star from the UFC. But I think you could say Chris Tione jumped in a little prematurely. Maybe, I mean, the way that Ruiz goes down here, she drops like a ton of bricks. So you can kind of see the stoppage from that perspective. But she largely passes the what-the-fuck test here. She hops back up and is seemingly ready to go. by the time Chris Tione gets there to make the stoppage. Now, the thing that I want to specifically reference as my "Are you fucking kidding me?" I don't know if you saw this, Ben, but if you could kill someone with a look, if you could actually murder Chris Tione with your eyes, as soon as the official announcement is read in this fight, Tione turns and he pats Ruiz on the back as if to say, "Hey, you'll live to fight another day." And she gives him this fucking look where if you could screenshot it, send it to your enemies, because it tells the whole story, man. Are you fucking kidding me? Like, Ruiz is somewhere today, right now, hoping Chris Tione stubs his toe or falls down, right? And maybe is not killed, but hurts himself badly. This was as dirty a look as I've ever seen in my life. Are you fucking kidding me?
Fucking kidding me?
That's going to do it for round number one. We'll be right back with round number two.
Well, Chad, she back. Misha Tate is back in the UFC and back in the win column. After retiring in the cage following her unanimous decision loss to Raquel Pennington at UFC 205 in 2016, Misha Tate, you know, goes and gives birth to a couple of humans, gets herself in seemingly phenomenal shape, and now she comes back, gets right in here in the cage against Marion Renault, who, it must be said, is 44 years old at the time of this fight and has one foot out the door, having already announced that this will be her last fight. But Misha Tate looked pretty good, man. Yeah. She looked pretty sharp. She looked like she may have even added a couple tools to the toolbox since last we saw her. What'd you think of this performance?
It's interesting to note that Misha Tate went ahead, had a retirement, took some time off, created a couple of additional human beings for the planet Earth, got herself back in shape, and came back and is somehow only 34 years old. Was 10, literally fully 10 years younger than her opponent in this fight. And like you said, man, kind of looked as good as ever. She's always been pretty well-rounded and effortlessly in this fight, kind of changed levels between the striking and the takedowns and was able to dominate this thing through those first couple rounds and then, you know, get the TKO stoppage there in the third. And this is a division that needs contenders. Let's be honest. We've had this thing almost cleaned out over the last couple years. So for Misha Tate to suddenly reemerge and to look as good as ever has to be couched as a positive development for the women's 135 pound division. I don't know how else to say it other than that. Like, I think she's immediately a player. I think she can be a title contender within another fight or two. She's still recognizable. She's still got this profile in the sport. I think the UFC would gladly promote a title fight with her involved in it. And it kind of seems like full speed ahead. Like, it seems like Misha Tate did the thing that some fighters do where, like, they're worn out. They've lost a couple fights. They're probably all beat up. Maybe they feel like they're at the end of their rope, and then they take a few years to sort of recharge, and then they come back, you know, looking fresh as a daisy and ready to go. And that's how it seemed with Misha Tate here.
You say how this division is in need of contenders, and the unstated part of that is because Amanda Nunes has beat them all up, and yet here comes a contender who Amanda Nunes beat up to claim the title. You know, that was UFC 200 back in the summer of 2016, you know, a full 5 years ago, and maybe a testament to Amanda Nunes' dominance that she's still the champ and has not wavered at all in that since then. And now Misha Tate comes back, but it also seems like when we start fantasy matchmaking future fights for Misha Tate, and a lot of it is between, you know, her and past opponents, people like Holly Holm. That's an idea that gets thrown around right away. I don't hate it. Also, her against people like Aspen Ladd, somebody hanging around, like a newer face hanging around at the top of the division. I don't hate that either. And yet, doesn't it seem like you shouldn't be in too much of a hurry to get back into that title fight? Maybe let's slow play it a little bit and see if Amanda retires or something. Because while I can make a case for myself that, like, I could see Misha taking competitive fights against Holly Holm and Aspen Ladd and those people, Nunes has only gotten better since then, man. Like, she is scarier now than she was when she looked quite scary busting up Miesha Tate at UFC 200.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think we would sit here on this podcast and talk about a professional women's fighter at 135 pounds alive on this planet today and say they're going to go out there and beat Amanda Nunes. Like, I don't think that that person exists right now. But, like, if you're Miesha Tate, you waited damn near 5 years and then you came back. I don't think you come back or return to the cage with the mindset of, I don't want to fight her again. Like, if you came back, you came back, man. And as we must assume that she's up for it, that she has that fighter's mentality and she would like her chances in a rematch. So I think she's kind of got the inside track here a little bit. Just she needs another win or two, I think. And I would be very surprised if Miesha Tate got those wins, but then was like, yeah, but I don't want any of that smoke, though.
Yeah, she's definitely not going to be the one to say that. But you're right, though. I mean, that is the other part of the division being kind of cleaned out, is that you win one fight, and it's a very realistic possibility that they're talking about a rematch between you and Nunes next, you know, depending on who that one fight is against.
Oh, yeah. People are talking about a rematch with Holly Holm. Man, Holly Holm's the number two rated bantamweight contender in this division right now, today. So if you're Miesha Tate and you win that fight, although I think that's, you know, that's a matchup that could go either way, I think, at this point. If you win that one, though, who else? Who else is there to even beat before you're the number one contender?
I wondered if there would be like a generation gap in the hype for Miesha Tate's return. Because
maybe
if you're a newer fan, even if you were around like kind of toward the tail end of her original run with the UFC, you might be forgiven if you're being like, I don't know, man, I saw Nunes spark her to take the title and then she lost to Raquel Pennington, looked kind of uninspired, retired in the cage while Brian Caraway was telling her not to in her ear. I don't see what the big deal is. And she comes back and a bunch of us old heads are excited about it. I can see you'd be like, I don't get it. And it's like, we're over here being like, man, you weren't around back in the Strikeforce Challenger days, man. You don't get it. You don't know what how Miesha Tate was one of those like early, like pre-UFC even deciding it wanted to do female fighting faces that got people interested and got people excited about the future of women's MMA. Like, I could see how maybe they don't understand that. I could also see how when Miesha Tate was talking about the reasons for her retirement and she was talking about sort of that relationship with Brian Caraway and a bitch about a lot of stuff going on in her life and how when it felt like things weren't going great and that there was some toxic stuff pulling her down in her life, her first thought was that you gotta cut the knot and get out of all of it. And that I could see how it became conflated in her mind as like, well, I'm not feeling great about anything about where I'm at. I need to live a completely different kind of life. And retiring from MMA seemed like that thing. Yet it's so rare to see somebody take that time. It's not rare at all to see somebody take that time away, come back telling everybody else and themselves, I feel great. I feel fresh. And we're going, yeah, because you haven't been doing this shit. Like, right. Because like maybe you've been in the gym and everything in a more controlled environment, but you haven't been putting your body through that regular grind that MMA will do to you. No wonder you feel great. Don't you think you would continue to feel great if you did not come back to this thing that made you feel bad in the first place? And often they get back in and realize it's a little bit harder jumping back in than they thought it would be. But Miesha Tate's that rare example. Do you think that it's just because she gets a little friendly matchmaking against Marion Renault, or do you think that she actually has improved from the last time we saw her?
Oh, I mean, I think she's probably definitely improved. She's probably, you know, I doubt that she just like got in the gym 6 months ago to get this thing ready for the comeback fight. She's probably been hanging around somewhere or other this whole time. Like, as we talk about a lot of these fighters are like, you know, alcoholics that quit drinking, but then they get a job as a bartender. They're still hanging around the bar. With Miesha Tate, like, you got to believe she's probably been around the sport, been around fighting and in the gym here and there probably for this entire 5 years. And I bet she has sharpened the skills and has gone through what I think is a pretty common experience here for MMA fighters to get away from the sport a little bit. And we know all of the reasons why this thing can be a little bit addictive for certain kinds of personalities. And like, she's still a young person. Her body probably feels better now because, as you said, she hasn't been getting beat up and hasn't gone through that grind, and maybe now you can do it a little smarter also if you're Misha Tate. Like I think the approach has changed a lot over the last 5 years, so maybe you don't have to get all beat up the way you were before. And just to look, if you look at the UFC bantamweight rankings, Ben, obviously Nunes is going to fight Juliana Pena coming up here. What is that at? UFC 266, something like that. But you got GDR, you got Holly Holm. And then you, as for newcomers, you kind of got Aspen Ladd and Irene Aldana. And then down here at number six, Yana Kunitskaya, who just lost. But is there anyone on this list that you would be more excited to see fight Amanda Nunes, or more interested to see Amanda fight Amanda Nunes again, than Misha Tate? Like, I don't see a name where I'm like, oh yeah, you got to give me this one before we see the rematch.
Yeah, I can't really disagree with that. But I also kind of think, like, when I see somebody who comes back to the sport and looks like they're happier, they're in a better place, you know, maybe got a better team with you and all that stuff around. I agree with you. I'm sure she didn't just like roll in 6 weeks ago and be like, drop her duffel bag on the floor of Extreme Couture and be like, hey, that's weird. You guys moved the bathrooms. The bathrooms used to be over there. Anywho, I got a fight coming up. Wondered if I could hit some mitts. Yeah. Get a
Where's
sweat
that
in
rascal
here.
Randy at? Is he still hanging around here?
Yeah. I'm sure that it was more of a process in figuring out that she could still do it. And then there's also a part of me that goes, oh man, you're plunging back into the void. You know, I hope it goes okay.
Yeah.
You know what though? The thing that I've never forgotten is Misha Tate going out there fighting Amanda Nunes at UFC 200. Kind of gets her whole shit broke, gets her nose just absolutely smashed before Amanda Nunes locks on the choke to finish her. She showed up to the damn post-fight press conference, her nose still leaking blood, just a giant-ass ice pack on her nose that she had to move just big enough so that it didn't block her voice going into the microphone as she was answering questions, then sat there and answered reporters' questions like a damn professional.
Yeah.
Not a whole lot of people would have done that. I mean, we saw how Ronda Rousey handled some of her two losses there, including the one to Amanda Nunes. Misha Tate was just like, oh, they want me to talk to the press? That's fine. Can I do it with my ice pack on my nose? If so, then I'm good. Let's do it.
Respect. All right, that's respect. That's going to do it for round number two. We'll be right back with round number three. Former champion Tyler Jeffrey Dillashaw returns from his JPD suspension to fight one Corey James Sandhagen, whose only loss in the UFC is to the guy who currently has that title, Aljamain Sterling. Now, of course, we could talk about the extenuating circumstances from that victory, but let's just say we got kind of an interesting matchup here for TJ Dillashaw in his return, and a fight that I think is going to tell us a lot about where Dillashaw fits into this new pecking order in the men's 135-pound division, just kind of judging by how this goes. Last time we saw him, he got pounded out by Henry Cejudo in that flyweight fight back in January 2019, the one where Dillashaw tested positive for EPO in the wake of it. But previous to that, it had been a while since we saw anybody best him at bantamweight. And if he comes out here and he can get a win over Sandhagen, you got to think he's right back in the mix. How do you see this fight going? What do you think Tyler Jeffrey Dillashaw still has left to give? And how much of an asterisk are you going to put next to any of his current accomplishments? Or is there anything that makes you feel less interested to see how TJ Dillashaw version 2.0 does here because of that just plain doping suspension?
Yeah, the asterisk question I think is the toughest one because, and I think honestly, it'll be affected by what happens here in this fight to some extent. Because you know, there are a lot of people who are just waiting to see him come back and lose this fight to then immediately go, oh, see, there it is. That's proof that the best things about TJ Dillashaw came from EPO. And that was the reason for success in the first place. He got caught. He definitely is not going to feel confident enough that he can get away with doing it again to come back here. I mean, if he's ever going to fight clean, you would feel like this is the one. You feel like he's probably fighting clean, right? You yeah. know Cody Garbrandt has a tweet in drafts right now ready to go, talking about how if TJ Dillashaw comes out and loses, that it's proof that he was never anything but what came out of the bottle. And I think that will be either way, like jumping to too many conclusions too soon, but that's kind of what we do. You know, that's a thing that we do in this sport, and you know people are going to be ready to do it here. And that's why I think the stakes for him are so high, and it's a tough situation that he's walking into, to be gone for 2 years, to have that hanging over you. I mean, this is one of the rare, very, very clear, unambiguous doping situations where yeah. there's no, it was a tainted supplement. There's no, I was injured and I was just trying to use it, like to get myself healthy enough to compete and earn money for my family. It was JP Dean just playing doping, just playing cheating, and he copped to it when he was caught. And there, you know, the only reason you're doing that is to give yourself an edge in his fights and to give yourself exactly the kind of edge that his fighting style benefited from. And so, like, there's a lot of that stuff like already working against him, and to come out after 2 years away anyway would be tough. Anybody could have some ring rust after 2 years away, but to be plunged into a fight with a guy who, you know, a younger opponent who is really on the come up, who seems to be really coming into his own, and is looking at this fight like, hey, I beat this guy, this former champ, I get on the mic and call for a title shot, and who would deny me? Like, there's a lot of stuff kind of working against TJ Dillashaw, or pressure that is mounted upon TJ Dillashaw in this one fight. And that's tough.
Yeah. He didn't get a Marion Renault here.
No, he did not.
Sure. And maybe some of that has to do with the circumstances of his absence and the suspension. And now he comes back in and is kind of get thrown to the fire here, thrown to the wolves back in a very high level bantamweight fight. Do you extend any kind of political capital to TJ Dillashaw because he didn't try to explain it away in any way? Like, EPO is a tough one to explain away.
Yeah, it is.
But he didn't give us the, my doctor, you know, injected me without my knowledge. He didn't give us the, I had an injury I was trying to rehab from. He didn't even give us the,
really
like...
You can't really do that with EPO, but yeah, I see what you mean.
Right, but you could say, hey, man, I was trying to make flyweight for the first time, and like I needed to have my cardio in tip-top shape, and I cut some corners, made some mistakes, won't do it again. Dillashaw didn't really say any of those things. So do you give him any credit for that? That like, he's one of the few guys that we've seen in this sport actually come out and say, I fucked up, and I cheated, and you caught me, and now I'm going to go away for a couple years, and then I'm going to come back.
Yeah, I give him a little bit of credit for that. And, you know, it's not like I'm without sympathy, especially if you're in this sport, and I've heard this from a lot of fighters who are like, you know, when I'm around gyms and seeing what other people do and hearing rumors about what other people do, this guy went to this gym and this is what he learned about the champ that comes out, that trains out of there. And it's easy to get a mentality that says everybody's doing it. And that if you want to have any hope of success at that top level, you'd better do it too. And I could definitely see where people get that in their heads and they go, well, all right, like, how bad do I want this? Do I want it bad enough to cheat and to dope? And if everybody else is doping, is it really even cheating? I can see how people get themselves into that frame of mind. And so, like, yeah, I've got some sympathy for that. It also seems though, like, we talked about Jeremy Stevens as a guy that the UFC, it seems like they just decided they like. TJ Dillashaw seems like another one of those guys. Do you remember back when we were trying to put together a Mighty Mouse TJ Dillashaw champ versus champ super fight, and Mighty Mouse's Demetrius Johnson was saying that Dana White kept telling him, you know, TJ deserves this. Like, this is the TJ deserves to have like one of these big kind of fights. And Demetrius Johnson would be like, fuck what TJ deserves. What about me? Like, why do you guys like him so much? And even now he comes back from the suspension and they seem like they're already really leaning hard into this sort of redemption arc thing. Like, you know, like TJ, he made this mistake. He owned up to it. And now he's out here like trying to prove himself all over again. And some of that is just like, I mean, that's just promotion. Like, that's the story that there is to tell. And so you got to tell it. But also the same way, you know, he's not getting the Marion Renault. We're not like easing him back in, but we're also not burying him on the undercard or giving him, you know, some tough ass Dagestani fighter who nobody has heard of, but who also is going to end up being a super tough guy. And you got to go out there and take, earn your place back. We're putting him in a main event against a guy who is a top contender. It's a guy who, if you can come back there and beat him, then you are kind of instantly a top contender again. So
yeah,
the other way to look at it is that the UFC is ready to forgive you, ready to make fans forgive you, ready to open up and embrace you warmly all over again. If you can go out here and win this fight, though, Corey Sandhagen right now, that's going to be a tough dude to beat.
Yeah, I agree. And at least with TJ Dillashaw, he said he was sorry, unlike some of the other redemptive stories we've tried to build in the UFC. But it goes, I mean, it remains to be seen how fans will react to his return. But yeah, Corey Sandhagen, obviously got some business he's still got to take care of between Aljamain Sterling and Peter Yan, but Corey Sandhagen is right there at number two behind Peter Yan in the rankings. So you got to think whoever wins this could be knocking on the door for whoever emerges from that grudge match rematch when Aljamain Sterling is healthy and he and Peter Yan can do it again. All right, let's do Just Saying Stuff, then we'll get out of here for this week. Ben, this week I'm just saying that is Jose Cuervo ad.
Okay.
With Michael Chiesa and Justin Gaethje. By the standards of an advertisement featuring two mixed martial arts fighters, this is a very good commercial. Both Justin Gaethje and Michael Chiesa pull this thing off, man. Pretty good delivery, pretty good timing, some pretty good comedic chops, I guess you could say, from both Gaethje and Chiesa. And I saw you tweet about this on Saturday night, and I will just echo your thoughts to say, we don't need to see it every damn break, man. When you got something good, when you got something halfway good, you don't need to run it into the ground. You don't need to make me hate it just by how many times you're going to show it to me during one evening. We don't got to do that, especially if things are going so well for the UFC with sponsorships and advertisements. Like, don't you got some other ads you could throw up there? And we just got to watch Justin Gaethje and Michael Chiesa get in each other's faces every single commercial break. Where's my trash truck commercial, Ben?
I know you want that trash
where's
truck
my, commercial. Where's my Carrier Motors UFC Light Heavyweight Division, now the trash truck division of the UFC? Where's that commercial? Give me one of those. I don't need to see Gaethje and Chiesa every single break. I'm just saying.
Just saying. You're ruining it. You know, and it's a great commercial, too. And they're ruining it. And you're right. That's the thing that came to my mind, too, was like, man, you got sponsors plastered all over the thing, and yet when you cut to commercial, people would think you only have one sponsor capable of making a TV commercial. What the hell, man? It's just you're ruining it through overuse, like the song of the summer on the radio on repeat, and I hate it. Well, Chad, I'm just saying. I know you had a little money on your guy Matt Matrione.
Matrione did not come through.
No. You know what did come through is yours truly with a parlay with the help from Tyrell Fortune, who I had winning against Matt Matrione. Finally hit one. Walked away sitting pretty in a pretty good spot with my $20 I never wanted to see again after this one. But this fight here where Matt Matrione is going to get real, real fired up about Dan Miragliotta missing an inadvertent clash of heads here. And yet, when you go to the replay, what you see is Tyrell Fortune changing levels and shooting in for that takedown. And then what you also see is Matt Matrione putting his face down directly into the path of Tyrell Fortune's head. Now, Fortune, the way his head is down as he's shooting in for that takedown, he can't see that Matrione has changed the positioning of his head. And yet, Matrione puts his face right down there, gets headbutted, essentially like in the forehead, and has a big lump right afterwards. But spends much of the rest of the fight, which doesn't go that much longer after he gets taken down there and thumped on a little bit on the mat, trying to loudly tell the referee about the headbutt, which I don't know what you think he's going to do about it at that point. Was there a clash of heads? Yes. Was it Matrione's fault? Also kind of yes. I'm just saying, I don't know if that's the one where you want to be like, these officials are screwing me and I can't get a fair shake. Because that one's kind of on you, Playboy.
Whoa. Wow.
Just saying.
Just saying. Yeah. Now that you hit the parlay, you're done with parlays now, right? You said you were going to keep betting the parlays until you hit one.
Uh-huh.
And now you're walking away on top is my is my assumption. Now you've tasted the sweet, sweet nectar of victory. That's all you need, right? You're retiring on top. Leave your gloves in the cage, my man.
That would be one way to think of it. Another way to think of it is that I finally got my system dialed in, and now I can't be stopped.
Oh, you figured out your system. I like it. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I look forward to $25 I never want to see, or $20. See, now I'm up in the stakes. $20 you never want to see again this week. Corey Sandhagen versus TJ Dillashaw. Aspen Ladd versus Macy Chiesa. How do you say this name?
Chiesa? I'm not John Hennick over here.
Got Mickey Gall on this thing, Ben. You got Ian Heinisch. You got some known names on here. Probably one we're going to want to spice up with some bets. So if anybody wants to get down with that, check us out over at patreon.com/comainevent. We'll be there all week. Wednesday live chat, Friday power hour, Thursday movie club. But right now, for the proper, thanks for listening, everybody. We're done. We're through. We're out. What would you say your system is?
Okay, I look around and I'm like, who's going to win these fights?
Okay, uh-huh. That's it?
I pick
the people you think are going to win. Mm-hmm. See, correct. That's where I fucked up last week, because I did pick the people who were going to win. I just got the wrong method of victory there for Islam Mahachev and Misha Tate.
And Misha Tate.
We did win their fights, but they just got a little too rascal, see?
My $20 that I never wanted to see again, and I turned it into about $43 that I was very happy to see.